Hi, this is John Stepling. This is Aesthetic Resistance. And joining me today are Michael Petruccelli and Molly Klein. This is kind of a part two of our previous discussion. And let us get into it. Hi, Molly. Hi, Michael.
Hello, hello.
How's it going, John?
Good, man. Okay, Molly, you had some thoughts, I know.
Yeah, I'm ready to start because we wanted to talk about enchantment. And I actually didn't get to read. I was going to read the Ernst Bloch that you had recommended. And I had read some of his stuff on Utopia years ago. But, you know, and somebody, Jake's father said, oh, you know, academics never admit when they haven't read something. So if you say, have you read this? And they say, oh, not for years. but I'm not saying that now. You can actually refresh my memory a little bit, but I don't, and I know that, and I glanced back at it yesterday and I'm like, I sort of remember it, but I don't really remember that book. But I wanted to raise this idea of enchantment because we were going to talk about dialectic of enlightenment and stuff like that, that Silvia Federici's book, Caliban and the Witch, which is really great, is about, you know, the transition basically to capitalism, not just as a mode of production, but as a kind of overall cultural transformation that it involved, which is the disciplining of the body. So she begins with this sort of medieval conception of the body, which is sort of Adam Kadmon idea, you know, the Kabbalistic idea that the original man is a universe and we think of our body holistically and it's all tied in, you know, astrology, the stars are connected to our different organs and, you know, the humoral medicine and all this stuff is very processual. It's very organic, right? And it's all about systems and living things reproducing themselves in a constant thing. And then capitalism comes along and has to discipline the body, right, and put it on the clock and make it a corpse. And she had this great sentence, which was the body had to die so that labor power could live. And I think that that's really brilliant. And then there's a sense in this, and then she goes from the medieval utopias, the peasant utopias, or, you know, this land of cocaine, which is just, you have everything, you know, you sleep all day, the milk falls from the sky, you know, it's just nice. And then you get the utopia, strictly speaking, Moore's utopia, which is a dream factory. It's a regimented, right, you know, horrible. And then that, when we see now with it, and then of course we have all the false utopias in science fiction, which are follow that utopia, the idea that our dreams are to be in a sort of very systematized, rigid universe where everyone's in a uniform, blah, 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 which is not the peasant idea of paradise. The peasant idea of paradise is you're leisured, you have sex all day, you eat, you drink, you play music, you know, life is good, right?
Right.
So, and then I was thinking about, this is why the class is so important all the time, and what Adorno's argument, you know, they do that Hegelian argument that reason itself, you know, both logos and ratio have in themselves, you know, this trap that, you know, you start down one road and you start down the road toward mastery of nature and you wind up, you know, in a totalitarian disaster, right, against life. But that's not a class, that misses class, which is that reason. There's a proletarian reason and a peasant reason, and then there's a bourgeois reason. There's the reason of the creators and the reason of the appropriators. And the right. reason of the creators is materialist reason. Like when Carlo Ginzburg looked into the trials of the Inquisition, you know, he has a lot of peasants. There's one peasant who gets condemned. I mean, there he has to walk around with a hat or whatever, but he gets condemned for saying, the priest shouldn't come and bless the fields because the only thing that can make the fields more fruitful is human labor and manure. That's what he says. And he won't take it back. And they make an example of him, right? So, but that's, you know, in that case, this is the reason of the peasants and materialism. And Adorno doesn't want to see that. He just sees reason and logos themselves as bad ideas that then, you know, crank away into the on this bad course. When what he's disguising there is class struggle.
Well,
right, and
I mean, he's aware of it, but he barely mentions it. The only time he ever mentions it is offhandedly and indirectly when he talks about history shaping the, you know, the ways in which this instrumental transformation, this hyper-rationality takes hold. I mean, he acknowledges that there are different historical forces for different classes, but that's it. It never goes any further, and it's right. apparently of just not very much interest to him.
No, it's and it's interesting because there's so much potential in that section, and it's also, in actuality, I have read the book, but not in a while, but in that section about Ulysses being the first modern man, and that he has all these capacities, you know, he's witty, he's satirical, he's individual, but he's a puzzle solver, right? And he's a pattern recognizer, so that those potentials are, you know, it's bourgeois, it's the liberalism in embryo, and yet it's also, you know, it's also the skills of a revolutionary leader. You know, they're not necessarily, like, he wants to have an essence in itself or a sort of mechanism that's, the world is running by thoughts, or, you know, paradigms that have these bad, you know, that they fall apart or they tend in one, and tendency is one thing, but that they must go that way, you know, rather than that separate people are fighting to make different things prevail. And then, it's really, the other thing I was thinking that this goes to, like we see in history, it's true there, you know, that each time the instrumental thinking and the rule, each time the ruling class has an offensive, that gets worse and more extreme kind of, but there's always this back and forth, like in the peasants, then you get the Renaissance and they were interested in Kabbalah while they were also trying to figure out plumbing, you know, they're doing all kinds of things, like, you know, it's always going back and forth. And then Romanticism is this huge, which you were talking about with Guy, right? And Romanticism, and Deleuze, I think, fits into this because he's the representative of that among the posties. The Romanticism is always returning to say, wait a second, you know, there's more here, and we need not to abolish rationality, but to make it perfect by understanding process.
Right.
Reifying our materials.
Right.
I think it's worth mentioning that I'm not sure that Adorno would completely agree that we should ignore necessarily class struggle. I was going back through and rereading section one last night because I was up and couldn't sleep and was like, oh, well, this will probably be good prep for tomorrow.
And you're not allowed to go anywhere.
Right, so. I just can't go anywhere. So he says that prior to the Enlightenment, there's one idea of knowledge, which is that you can only understand knowledge through the spirit. And that's like the primary form of knowing things. But that with the birth of Enlightenment, anything that can't be quantified can't be real. If I can't count it and hold it and see it, it's not real. And so there's this idea of our brains as having... rather than being like a part of us, your brain becomes something separate. It's just a response organ. It sees it, nothing original can come from it. And then he goes on to say, knowledge does not consist in mere perception, classification, and calculation, but precisely in the determining negation of whatever is at hand. Instead of such negation, mathematical formalism, whose medium, number, is the most abstract form of the immediate, arrests thought at mere immediacy. The more completely the machinery of thought subjugates existence, the more blindly it is satisfied with reproducing it. Enlightenment regresses to the mythology it has never been able to escape, for mythology had reflected in its forms and essence the existing order. In the terseness of the mythical age, as in its clarity of scientific formula, the eternity of the actual is confirmed and mere existence is pronounced something as the meaning it obstructs. So he is pretty clear that, you know, this is a reflection of what's happening around you. These ways of viewing thought aren't the be-all, end-all, but they are the ways that are encouraged by the existing order.
These are bourgeois, these are just official thought. This is the clerks, it's the problem of the professional intellectuals. But then he presents it as if it's running the whole society, as if people aren't every day having practical reason, you know,
right.
practical knowledge, and that also that they would, how would these people like be, have anything to eat that they could make these stories? You know, like, obviously some people still know how to grow things and feed them, regardless of their fetishes. Yeah,
I think he was, I think these criticisms are legitimate, and certainly people have made them before, and it's true. And Adorno is a Hegelian, and then he, you know, he borrowed very heavily from Kant, and strangely enough from Kierkegaard. But what concerned him was, I think, twofold. And it's interesting. You should read Robert Hulot Kantor's book on essays on Adorno, but especially the essay back to Adorno, because he dissects Dialectic of Enlightenment a bit and talks about this uneasy relationship between Horkheimer and Adorno. Anyway, yeah, the chapter on Ulysses apparently was Adorno, and Horkheimer was uncomfortable with it, in fact. But anyway, the point is that, you know, he was concerned, you know, hugely with the thought processes and ways that the pathway to fascism, how we got to fascism, you know, in World War II. I mean, that was the overriding concern he had. And the very later lectures of Adorno were really interesting, I think. They're fragments and notes to students and stuff, but they're really wonderful. And his kind of despair comes through at the way in which fascism lives on in this deadened bourgeois consciousness. I mean, he really was anticipating all the stuff we're talking about, in a sense. But yeah, I think those criticisms are right. I think Michael, you know, touches on just evidence of what I said, that it didn't interest him. He mentions it and he's aware of it because he's not a stupid guy, but it didn't interest him. Right. He was interested in
the
mechanisms or something, you know?
Well, I think they didn't have any faith. I mean, the thing is, these are first of all, right, a lot of the German intellectuals, and they got sort of arbitrarily expelled from German culture by Nazi ideology about their being Jewish, but that's their culture. They were contributed to this culture and made it. And they want to blame it on the working class. And they also feared, you know, because these are people who actually had to run away from their country, right? Because they were afraid of the public. So they have turned against the working class, you know, because they kind of closed their eyes. They didn't participate in the revolution of the communist working class. And then they, you know, sort of imagined everyone was a brown shirt kind of thing. And
right.
they have.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean,
when they talk about, you know, instrumental rationality, the way they always put it is like civilization as rationalized irrationality, or they keep saying the subjugation of nature. Like what I mean by nature, they're talking about the conquest of the working class, of the communist movement, of the communist world movement, but they imagine it as this timeless subjugation of nature, sort of like Francis Bacon, you know, that the masses are just fauna. You know, they're part of the landscape, mm-hmm. and rationality is about controlling them. And they don't see them as subjects, partly because of their trauma. And they are all traumatized.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that's right. I think that was shaped their thought, you know, and
it shaped their thought. And it's their own, you know, they want to expel. Well, the worst, of course, is Hannah Arendt. Who wanted to transfer the guilt from her boyfriend, who was an actual Nazi, an important Nazi, onto his victims.
Well, you know, and she had to cape for a Agamben, who's, you know, just as much of a horrific fascist as her boyfriend was.
We could talk about the Agamben response to the Corona event, because
he's so 101, you know, he's so like he's so proud of his grasp of the obvious, and then
yeah
he's so yeah and
very very Slavoj.
Yes, they're very, very similar, and friends. You know, they're good friends. But
right, I say the most simplistic thing and say it in vague terms, so it sounds like I'm a genius. It's great.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, but I want to get back to disenchantment a bit.
Yeah, disenchantment. And that enchantment, the whole idea, I mean, because romanticism comes back over and over, right? Or some with different names, romanticism. And Marx was a romantic. I mean, he belonged to this tradition. It comes back over and over, trying to, it's a class war issue. Like the peasantry, the masses bring romanticism back all the time. Some intellectuals go over to them, you know, or whatever, you know, shape it, lead it, whatever. And then it's always being, you know, killed, often by ridicule, right? That's a big mm-hmm. thing. The ridicule of the instrumental and computational thought, the financialization, that idea and stuff is always coming back. But that's, when I was thinking about the CGI, it's perfect because the instrumental bourgeois thinking, the proprietor, the landlord thinking has now just started to mimic in this. It's like its whole tactic is mimicry, tweeness, kitsch. Mimicking its the romantic opposition. That's what CGI is, right? Because the first CGI was always making these sort of like adorable little cutesy pootsy, wonderlands, right? That are right. Supposed to be, and they feel like Disney Main Street.
Right, right.
Epcot. Well,
I think there's the mimicking, that notion is a really smart observation, and what do I want to say? The way CGI is employed now, first of all, is ubiquitous, right? And nearly everything on every screen that you view is manipulated. It's manipulated imagery. Almost all of it, literally, has been, you know, treated and tweaked and changed and adjusted, and so it is completely normalized. The idea of this sort of deadness and strange digitalization of image is completely normalized, and people accept and so forth. And it affects storytelling, and it affects emotional response. And I talked a bit in the blog post about how mimesis works with regard to it. But when I was thinking about the coronavirus, and if you read social media and you read mainstream newspapers, and you know, this pandemic is like a kitsch pandemic. It is not the tragic plague I was talking about last night, about, you know, the plague as a absolutely, you know, rich allegorical field for human tragedy. But this is not, right. You know, first right. of all, because there's no piles of dead bodies, and there's not going to be until Bill Gates, you know.
Yeah, it's just a show.
Truckloads of vaccine, but that's another story. But it's like the narrative that is being layered over this story, the narrative explanation of why everybody's under house arrest, it's like a kitsch storytelling. It's like a children's story almost. It barely rises to the level of cheap science fiction. It's not even that.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's really also all the strength of it is relying, like I look at Facebook where I have, you know, friends from high school and stuff, and like everything, the people who are really committed to this story have just slipped it into an episode of the Trump show. For them, it's a story of Trump's failure, and that's why it's exciting. And all they don't care about that, they don't want to read, you know, when Sweden puts up the data from the hospitals, they don't want to look at that. All they want to see is how Trump is reacting to whatever the new piece of information is, whatever the new event is. That the whole thing is just, they love the virus headline because they think it is going to be part of their war on Trump or their right. exposure of Trump. And there's no other interest in it at all.
No, it's true. It's true. But it is also, and I don't want to digress too far into this, but Michael and I were talking before you joined us, before we started recording, about the similarities between the climate discourse and the coronavirus discourse, and at least in social media. And boy, social media is, you know, a massive influencer these days, isn't it? But the same two things. One is a constant 24-hour-a-day stream of junk science, parroted by people who are not scientists, who are not doctors, who know nothing about any of what this stuff is that they're saying. But they parrot it, and they're hugely invested. They're emotionally invested to a really crazy degree, and they get absolutely furious if you disagree and you show them Sweden or Belarus or countries, and they don't want to see it. And they're hugely invested in this.
Yeah, they really are. They want people to die. They want to see those bodies for the moral story or whatever. And they love stories of like, oh, this guy thought this was overblown and now he's dying. And they love that story. And it's so perverted.
It's all very gamified. You choose your side. And I don't know how many times I've been told, well, you're going to be sorry when the numbers start to rise, when there's piles of death. You're right. I will be sorry. I will view it as an absolute tragedy.
The second thing, but
let me just finish before I forget. The second thing is, so there's a stream of junk science, but the second thing is, you know, and you and I, Molly, both commented on this, I saw on Facebook. The second thing is the same people and the same kind of character structure, personality type that was scolding everybody and stigmatizing people about climate change. Oh, the temperature is going to rise 0.5 degrees and, you know, you're attacking poor Greta. She's a teenager. She cares. Yeah. You don't care. Earth is going to be over in 20 years if we don't, you know.
And there are too many people already.
And of course, too many people. And those same people that were there doing all of that are now doing the same thing with coronavirus. No, you don't care about your grandparents. You don't care about, we have to be locked up. What about the poor nurses in these overworked hospitals?
Right, and the people are dying of 90, like they're acting like people, they're like people are dying who are over 90. And it's like, you have your work cut out for you if you're gonna put an end to that. You know, like the life expectancy in the United States for men is 76 years now. You know, they're already on borrowed time. But also it's like they're being handed yellow pages, right, in the script. Like we were writing this story that there are too many people, and now we're, that didn't work, that tested badly, and now we have this other story. It's completely different moral universe.
Start making the phone call to Peter Thiel and Elon Musk. You can work out A, how to live forever, and B, how to never have another child because you're all hooked up to a computer.
Yes.
And it'll be great. Who gives a shit?
Pertinent, because my point was at the end of that was these same people are doing the same thing, and you know, it's all kind of cuckoo and junk science and stuff, but it expresses something that is A, what Michael just sort of offhandedly mentioned. There is this deep fear of death and that people die. And when you tell people, but 400,000 people died from malaria last year, and it was there was not a single headline anywhere in any paper that I can remember talking about malaria. Why is that? This, you know, however many people have died, and yes, it's a virus outbreak, and you know, but people die of diseases, especially ones who are 90 years old, and there's a denial that death takes place. You know, you say, well, 12 people died at the hospital. Yeah, people go to the hospital to die.
Yeah, everyone dies. Methodist Hospital in Brooklyn. I mean, you know, nobody gets out of there alive.
Your choice is the hospital or...
It's not what happens there.
On hospice care died, and I was like, it's a shame. I get why you're sad, but also, you know, that's kind of the point.
What a shocker.
This way to die is also really terrible. It's true, but they're also, like, then they're they're refusing to listen to the ER and the ICU doctors who are learning how to actually treat this. And they say, you know, it's not like pneumonia, it's actually hypoxia. You know, there it's like high altitude. There's something, the surfactant in the lungs is being inhibited by the virus. And there are ways to like, actually, they're killing a lot of people with too much ventilator, apparently. And, you know, they didn't do that on purpose. These are people trying to heal people, learning. They're getting no help from the actual, you know, the virologists and stuff. They're way behind because it's a new thing, right? So they don't know how it works or anything. And so they're learning on the patients, and then people get angry if you're sharing this information. Like, for if you actually get this, you should go in knowing that don't let them intubate you, you know, because that's going to kill you. And the virus probably won't if you get other, you know, there are many mechanical methods, or not many. There's a mechanical method of assisting your respiration through the crisis that will cure you. You know, but they don't want to know about a cure. They only want to know that if you get this thing, it's a plague, right? And you die, because that's the screenwriting. It's so infuriating. It's really, it's painful, because you see people, you know, literally rooting for this death. Right. But when you were saying about malaria, you know, at first the reaction would be like, oh, well, this has to do with worthy and unworthy victims or whatever. It's not even that. It's just where, what is being slotted into what point part of the formula for the single shooter experience. It doesn't even matter, you know, the ethnicity and stuff. I mean, that matters to a point, but they're being told, they're being made to identify with the victim, right? Or they're, and actually it's more about the righteousness. It's more and more that.
Yes, but that's my point, yes.
And you can't let it get away with anything. It's a motherfucker and it has to pay.
Yeah.
You know, that it's not just it's a protein.
Because there has been some kind of like buildup of like unused, you know, righteous indignation or something, and the need to create a self on social media, but maybe just overall that cares and is this compassionate person. But it always takes the form now of rooting for, you know, fascist authoritarian state policy, and rooting for, you know, the numbers to go up to prove that they're right, and scold other people. I mean, that's the direction the society has taken, that it is stigmatizing and shaming, and it is that almost before everything else. Because one thing for certain, all of these people who are claiming to care so much is that they don't really care.
No.
That's an absolute truth.
And they're very interested
in this. It's histrionics.
They're interested in this. Their only conception of how a universe works and how a country works is the despot at the top determines everything going down. Like, the arguments that I have on Facebook is like, I'm saying, the federal government does not run hospitals. It sort of runs the VA, but that's its only thing. It should not run hospitals. They know nothing about running hospitals. The way you have the hospitals work is that the doctors tell the hospital administrators what they need, and the hospital administrators go and buy it. And if you want to help the hospitals, you just expand their budgets. You give them gifts of money, and then they order more whatever they need. And that's how you expand hospital service. And this, they're like, no, they want Trump in charge. They want Trump to steal all, literally, they're applauding Cuomo going into hospitals and taking the ventilators away and saying he's going to decide where they go. Of course, he puts them on a truck and forgets where he parks it. I mean, that's the whole point of that, right? So, but they really believe that fascism as a model, like, they don't believe in democracy at all. They really believe, and we saw this in Katrina, remember, with Bush, that unless Donald Trump is telling each emergency room doctor how to treat a patient, that the world will shut down, that he is a king in the fairy tale who determines that happens in this society. They really don't think he's a public servant. They don't think there's any limits on his power, or should be. And when I say just get out of the way of the emergency room doctors and the ICU doctors, because these people at this point, they're not even making that much money. They're there because they have a calling. Let them work. They're good at this. Right. You know, instead they say, no, you know, it has to be federally coordinated. It has to be federal. And I'm saying, but you're saying Trump is a moron. And it's true. This is their story now is save us, Trump, you fucking moron. Save us. Right? That there's these two things they're getting. Like the society doesn't work because Trump is an idiot. It's like, well, leave Trump out of it. He has no role in the running of hospitals.
But there's a strange
capitalism. It's a commerce.
Yeah. There's a strange disconnect. When you bring up the fact that you do realize everybody is in quarantine under house arrest, you know, you get social distancing, and that this is triggering you know, the loss of jobs and a lot of problems for families that have kids home from school. It's creating all manner of problem. It's going to increase homelessness and poverty and hunger. It's going to be a big depression, all of these problems that undoubtedly somebody said more people will end up dying of suicide than they do from the virus. And that's quite possible, but there's a disconnect from even thinking about that.
Four times already the suicides in the U.S. are four times the virus.
Yeah, but it's part of this fairy tale. Yeah. It's part of this kitsch fairy tale, right?
And this fragmentary thing. Yeah. Hello?
Yeah, no, I'm here. That was a strange glitch. Sorry. Yeah, no, it's part of this fairy tale in which everything returns to normal afterwards and we have, you know, the severity of the policies saved us. And, you know, and I hear people that I think of as reasonably intelligent people actually write things like, well, Boris Johnson is now in hospital and, you know, in intensive care and he's critical. And that proves that this is not a hoax.
Well, who said it was a hoax? Yeah.
And I said, who the fuck said it was a hoax?
No one is pretending there's no illness.
It's a virus. No, it's a virus. That's not the issue.
No, they don't understand. Like, and then how do they think public health policy has been made all this time? I mean, obviously, you could save a lot of lives with enforced chastity. You'd have no STDs. If you took driver's licenses away from men, you would save a lot of lives. You know, they don't. Like public health policy is about public health. It's not about this villain, but that's the whole thing. It's the structure of the villain. Just like you remember when Putin Putin was sort of tasked with changing the environment when he gassed everybody in that theater, you know, because it used to be that like a cop would boast of retiring without ever pulling his gun, right? Without ever unholstering his gun. The whole thing is the cops were so brave, they would go into a situation of an armed hostage taker and their job would be to get the hostages out alive. And now the whole idea is you could kill the hostages, right? Your whole thing is to get, or that the cop itself, the cop's job is to protect the cop himself. Like he's become an embodiment of the system of order, and any threat to him justifies any killing. And that's the exact opposite of what protect and serve, like the police in the old culture used to believe.
But this is that part when I was writing in the blog post, and I wish I had been more articulate in a way, but it just started to occur to me the way in which these style codes, the you know, resurrection of older codes and symbols and story motifs from National Socialism or wherever find expression now in strange ways. And I mentioned Trump's gold curtains. You know, this is a really overdetermined image on something. One could write a whole treatise on those gold curtains. But it's things like the exceptionalism of the police. If you kill a cop, you are more severely punished because police are special. And it is a more heinous offense. And then this is like these strange hierarchies.
It's going right back to aristocratic, you know, he's the representative of the king. So it's you're violating the majesty of the king. You know, it's amazing because it used to be the cops were so proud of the fact that they were putting their own lives on the line to serve the public.
Right.
It would be brave that they wouldn't go in blasting when there were hostages, you know, and now it's like they don't, there's no, you're supposed to sacrifice hostages to restore order.
So I was looking for a scene from an old play, Waiting for Lefty, which of course was written about the cab strike in San Francisco. It was immensely popular at the time that it was produced. But there's these two men talking. One is Dr. Barnes, the other is Dr. Benjamin, who's a medical student. And they're firing Dr. Benjamin.
Right.
Because he's Jewish at the time and it's very frowned upon. He actually makes mention of it. He says, well, with all those wealthy Jews on the board, and he says, well, I don't see much difference between wealthy Jews and wealthy Gentiles. Seems to me that they're both all cut from the same cloth. And then he goes on to say, doctors don't run medicine in this country. The men who know their jobs don't run anything here except for a motorman on a trolley car. And, you know, that's just as true today. And that's actually what these people are advocating for is, you know, I personally want Donald Trump and Elon Musk to go in and I want them to actually show you exactly how you're going to treat this illness. Never mind, you're a fucking doctor and you don't know anything about, you clearly don't know how to do your job. You've never cured anyone.
But it's because people have really lost the ability to think. I mean, you know, subliterate and innumerate and, but just the logic fails people at the most fundamental, rudimentary level. I just see this constantly. And part of it is the way these stories, the way media, mainstream media and the government construct these stories for consumption. You know, they know the conclusion that people will reach if they read and accept this story. And it is ahistorical. It has, you know, it's full of fallacies and fantasy, you know, I don't know, allusions to things that never existed and on, all this sort of stuff we know. And so people kind of have lost the ability to question it, the curiosity to question it. They shop for it, they buy it, they try it on, and if it works, they stick with it. You know, there's a brand loyalty that, you know, and as Michael said, there's this binary thing too. People can't think past the binary. And even when certain things like Scotland was gonna pass this ridiculous law, I forget what it was, but some anti-democratic legal thing connected with Corona, and it was defeated. But that was not in the headline because the people that organized to stop this from passing are rendered invisible, right?
Right.
The people who are actually activists that fight against the system, even in sort of pseudo left papers, they are rendered invisible in the narrative. It didn't happen just because it didn't happen.
Right. The algorithm didn't allow it.
No. It is erased. Those people are always erased.
Yeah, because and then when you show them, it's only to pathologize them, like that it's paranoia, that research is, you know, connecting the dots in some paranoid way, and it, you know, literally trying to look, gather evidence and evaluate the source, and you know the basic functions that we have. That there's this idea that because that's imperfect always, that it's all, you know, insanity. And so the only thing you can do, right, is attach your loyalty to, you know, whoever the hero is. And the hero doesn't even have to be good. They just have to be a winner.
Right. Well,
you know, so now it's the winner, you know, so that you just want to go with the winning. It's like a bet. Your idea of truth is like you're making these judgments in like the OTB every day.
And
you
it's
want
so
a ticket that pays.
It's so steeped in people wanting to prove others wrong too, and showing you, aha, you see you were wrong. And I remember in Poland, one of the jokes was your neighbor, you know, shows up one day with a Rolls Royce. And the, you know, the dream is not, God, I wish I could have a Rolls Royce too. The dream is, I hope somebody steals this fucking car.
Right.
And that's kind of the society we live in the West now, in the United States too. It is, people are just trained to kind of turn on their neighbor and be resentful of everything that they get wrong, and, you know, friends at the office get right, or, you know, wherever it is. And, but it's all kind of bullshit anyway. It's all kind of manufactured stories. And I mean, the coronavirus is one of them. Yes, it's real. Yes, people have died, you know, but you have to look at it in some context, and
yeah, historical, you're not gonna stop, and Jeff.
But people don't. Anyway, I do want to get back to some of the earlier points that you, Molly, made at the beginning of the show, because I think they're really interesting. And
about enchantment.
Pardon?
Yeah, about enchantment.
Yeah, about enchantment, because I find this really important. And when I was writing the blog post yesterday, and I was looking at I had watched this Disney cartoon from 1937, mind you.
Yeah.
And I thought, it really is remarkable, and you find these continuums, and they're you know, they're really pretty apparent. There's a certain kind of style code, and a certain kind of, we're talking about film here for a second, there's a certain kind of visual technique that an exaggerated camera movement, you know, that with gratuitous flourishes and things shot to make them look, you know, bigger than life and grand and all of these things. And yet the content may be, you know, very simple and minor you know, insignificant, but that doesn't matter. It's just a melodrama. So they're treating it with this exaggerated, the importance of the camera technique somehow. And the Disney stuff is weird, because those early cartoons, the ones 37, and then he made a whole series in the 40s. And say what you will about them, they've always been frowned upon, because Disney himself was such a kind of terrible man and a right winger, and he exploited his artists, and all of this stuff is true. But there is a visual intelligence to those films that's completely lacking today in animation. I mean, unless you go to like really remote, strange, you know, art houses and see somebody making something, probably. I don't even know, people like, you know, Sponk Maher and so forth. But otherwise, if you look at children's shows today, they're just grotesquely bad. And
yeah. And they're disorienting. Like in the old Disney things, I mean, they are really beautiful, and could talk about the ideology of the stories, but it made me think of that, George George Trow's thing, within the context of No Context, how the frame gets taken off the magazine covers, how frames get framing, right. You know, and in these cartoons, like, yeah, when you want to, it was, you know, foreshortening, like Renaissance techniques, like you walk, yes, through a cathedral, right? But you would see, so we're looking at a castle, we want to make it charming and great, so the point of view that you're being shown is up at it, like you're a small person, but also then the little foliage will be on the frame to fill in a perspective, so that you're always oriented toward this thing, like, yes, it's size and your size, and you can change point of view and stuff. And with the CGI and everything, that is just arbitrary, right? The point of view is arbitrary, and there's never any frame. So things just exist somewhere where you don't know if they're big or small.
I do think it's interesting to note, though, that Walt Disney, to some extent, ended up kind of buying into his own bullshit a little bit. I think of like Celebration Florida, where, like, you know, it's a whole town that's just built on this post-40s kitsch.
Right.
Where, like, you know, everything is perfectly pristine, and it is the American dream, and, you know, it's.
Well, Disney was, you know, I mean, you know.
He was evil.
Yeah, he was a really bad guy. And you know, when Disney World or whatever it was called opened in Southern California, I remember going as a young kid, and I loved it.
Me too. Yeah.
But you know, Future World or whatever it was called, you know, there was
Tomorrowland.
Yeah, Tomorrowland. You know, Tomorrowland was like Alphaville. You know,
yeah.
It was just a fucking nightmare.
Main Street.
Wanted even at the time to live in Tomorrowland. Like, please, no.
He's also interesting because he's the first of this new brand of fascist. Like,
yeah,
you know, he is the first one to. Like, you know, the old fascists, I was talking with Natasha about this last night, the old fascists craved death to some extent. There was a desire for abolition of the self. Disney sought to totalize himself. He was like, yeah, I'm going to freeze myself in ice and live forever. And, you know, there's nothing you can do about it.
Once again, they're the class valances of fascism. That's the thing. You know, everything is really simple when viewed through, you understand that there's a class struggle in every one of these things, right? So even in fascism, there's the petty bourgeois versus the bourgeois. I mean, there's not really a proletarian fascism, but there is a petty bourgeois fascism. And
there's definitely
a lot
that, like,
art came out of that. A lot of their
there's definitely that, like, lumpen street gang fascism typified by
fascism.
Like, street the black gangs shirts. And
right, they thought they were like the Hussard de l'Amour, and you know that they would be like, you know, if you reach 30, you're a scoundrel.
Right, and we see it with the, like, you know, in Pennsylvania, we have Keystone State Skinheads. They rebranded as Keystone State United. We still know what they are.
They
paint themselves as Vikings. Like, you're not a Viking, you're an overweight 40-year-old. Get out of my way.
The fantasy of the, I know, the master, people who really believe in the master race, but when you get a picture of them, it's like Slavoj Žižek. You know, you look at a picture of him and he thinks he's a master race. You really wonder what's going on.
I mean, that's always, I mean, like, it's always guys with.
I don't want to reinscribe it. I don't want to reinscribe those values, but it's
But you're right. He was the first kind of New Age fascist, but he was that world, that vision, and you touched on something really important, Molly, that he was imitating Renaissance art and certain kinds of perspective, and the things were overdrawn. You don't get those many slides ever in animation anymore.
Right.
And it's why they look so elegant in a way. They are quite beautiful and spellbinding. But he was borrowing, you know, he was a rube from Marceline, Missouri. I mean, he was an absolute hick, and he had very provincial tastes, and it comes through in a kind of this weird farm boy admiration for that European art stuff.
Right.
Now he became self-delusional at a certain point, but those perspectives on the castle or whatever, you know, you're looking at that he used and employed to create these cartoons, that stuff has linkage to Norman Rockwell, it has linkage to, you know, Thomas Kincaid, it has linkage to Donald Trump's Golden Curtains, it has linkage to Las Vegas. It was a really profound influence on American taste. It validated the fact that Americans had no taste, not even bad taste, they had no taste, and that was okay. Disney was saying what you know, Main Street in Disneyland, Main Street was white, wholesome, Midwestern, and absolutely conformist, of course, you know, and in those early days,
sex.
I remember going to Disneyland, you had to have your hair cut. He wouldn't let anybody into the park who had sideburns. I mean,
there's no sex in that world. There's no brothel.
Right, absolutely. People spawn from each other's hips like Zeus.
Right. That's something else I was going to say about enchantment. I mean, this is a little thing. The other thing about disenchantment and reenchantment is like the enchanted human, the image of the enchanted human is Isis and Osiris or Mary and Jesus. It's always going to be that we're a species that reproduces a certain way, that most of us are women, that all of us begin as female, etc. And then you go to the Vitruvian Man, you know, Leonardo's image, which is, you know, a man, an adult male in a sealed off little bubble, that's really a corpse. You know, it's not our species at all. And yet that becomes the dominant image in the calculating, the proprietor, that's the image of the proprietor.
Boy, that's really interesting because, you know, we talked last time and I wrote about this somewhere and I talked about it somewhere, maybe, I don't know, on Instagram or something. The man in the glass booth thing, because it came up in the song.
Right?
He was behind the glass partition. I hadn't thought of the Da Vinci, because that's really true too, isn't it? There's something there. I don't know quite what it is, but there is some fascination with that hermetic separation. You know, and it ties in with the aesthetics, the style codes of how all of us talk about instrumental thinking and logical positivism and all that, that the disenchantment was hermetically cutting us off from the dirty, the moist, the dark,
undomesticated. Yeah, and this goes to the what's good in Deleuze, you know, like he talks about the body without organs, which is just a sort of inverted quote from Marx, where Marx said that that nature is our inorganic body, meaning that, you know, an adequate stream of water is as much a part of a human being as, you know, your heart. You could live without your legs, but right, you can't live without an adequate stream of water and air. That we're an organic process that, you know, metabolizes what's outside us and makes what's outside us. That there's no cutoff, you know. And that when we start to imagine ourselves as this kind of divine machine, as a sort of God on earth that just dominates the outside, instead of, you know, that we metabolize it, that we're actually made of it, then you start to have that really, well, Tevelite thinks that's the sort of beginning of creating capital in your brain.
It's very interesting. And I think that I think the trend toward the enthusiasm for artificial intelligence is also this body negative fear of, geez, it goes back to, you know, male fantasies again, doesn't it?
Yeah.
There is running through, but this is what interests me, you know, is that in all of this, fascist symbology and mythos, certain things keep recurring. And in the struggle against that, you know, there are certain things that are singled out for punishment or erasure or, you know, invisibility being censored somehow. And this ties in with the whole thing of algorithms and this obsession with predictability. Because there's something about sex and procreation and shit that is just not predictable.
Proves the democratic equality. I mean, it proves the wrongness of racism and class and stuff. Because, I mean, that's the love story is the ultimate democratic story, because it doesn't matter. The barriers that are put up by society don't matter. People fall in love, cross them.
Right. Well, period. I mean, there is an extraordinary... One of the things that have come up with screen and CGI too, see, I think these things are all linked and I'm just free associating here, so forgive me, but I see CGI as sex negative. You know, I think I could defend that argument actually, given enough time, because they're the only irregularities. I mentioned the stone, the repaved square in Krakow, Poland, where they used computer generated architectural drawings, and all the stones were suddenly uniform and grotesque, right? And an affront to people. And the old medieval stones were uneven to walk on, but they were beautiful and sensuous and tactile and all of these things. And CGI has this, it is perfect. It's always perfect. And whatever is imperfect is intentionally imperfect. It's a sign of, you know, see, you know, we're displaying this character with a certain imperfection or something. It is, CGI is a corrective. It's a manipulation. It's an advertisement policy. It's a way to correct something that naturally that is seen as wrong because it's not predictable. It's unruly. Can't be trained to the process can't be manipulated or trained in a way that ends up with the results that everybody at the, you know, the CEO and the board agreed on would be the results. They can never really determine that. CGI is part of this apparatus of correction that takes care of that for you.
I mean, like the eugenics logic, it's like a Nazi eugenics logic made practical. Like they could dream of that, you know, Albert Speer and Hitler, I mean, could dream of their future. And it's, you know, that Alfred Rosenberg would have loved CGI. He would have, maybe he wouldn't even have had to kill so many people. They'd just sit there on the computer and make their little Nazi world.
And of course, there's like this trend where, so at one point, like correcting something that was wrong in nature in your art was an intentional move, right? Murat is painted without his, like, you know, he had a horrible case of eczema that was untreated, right, and he would bathe in milk for it. But he's painted without that because the intention is to show that even in his death, he is greater than he ever was alive. He is more perfect by dying. He becomes a martyr for the cause. But it's not the same kind of fascistic understanding of perfection. It's not, well, you know, he had to be perfect. It was, in life he was a flawed man, but in death we can look past those flaws and he can become what he always was intended to be.
Right, and there's still an understanding of the distinction between the concrete referent and the image. And then in CGI, there's no concrete referent at all. There's only image. And then that this is, you know, it's the financial world. You know, the financial world is a net over the reality that is eliminating. And Mike did a lot of reading about the arguments between Lenin and Bogdanov, which also relate to this, right?
Right. So, I mean, ultimately, like, Bogdanov was wrong in many ways, as was Lenin. Like, both of them were imperfect, and that's okay. Like, there's no reason that we have to couch those facts. Lenin made errors, Bogdanov made errors. Ultimately, their argument was probably the greatest one, really, because it split Lunacharsky and Lenin, who are both brilliant in their own right, and both brilliant orators, and very, very capable.
Lenin was aware that he was misrepresenting the actual topic because for a political reason, which is interesting. But their argument is about Mach and about positivism. I mean, it's about the representations that become politically actionable, right, of reality.
Right.
So, and you know, sorry.
You know, you see it with Gorky too, and the God Builders and all of that, where Lenin intentionally paints it as this idea that they want to make an actual divine being. Whereas if you read Mother, that's clearly not what Maxim Gorky ever intended. The main character at one point is talking to a man and he says, well, if you take away God, what will I still have left? And the main character ends up saying, well, you can be your own God and you'll never be alone, because you're surrounded by thousands of gods. You're surrounded by the working class, and the working class is the only mover of history.
Right.
It actually takes power away from this kind of divine right to own things, this divine right to, you know, I can do this because God allows me to. Well,
that reminds me of something. I mean, to interrupt you, but this was in the blog piece I just wrote. I hate to always sort of footnote myself here like this, but and I forget where I was first bumped into this idea, but it touches on, because what interests me is the counter-revolution that happened after the 60s, right? And maybe in the next podcast, we can get to that, the ways in which, you know, the 60s shaped the practices of the state in correcting that problem. But the environmental movement today continues to express itself in these terms. I'm not sure why what said Michael made me think of this, but I did. In terms of something that is, there is always a declaration about, well, we must protect nature and keep it pure and pristine and wild and all of these things. And that is always the voice of the man who owns the manor house and the ground.
Yeah. It is, right. It is a classic Capability Brown. It's so,
it's
true.
Or Repton. Works. It's the,
it never it, works. Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to see, yeah. I want to see decorative sheep. I don't want to see dirty peasants.
Yeah, or, no, exactly. Know. Exactly.
It's so true that view and that manor house, that's why we use fascism to talk about Disney, to talk about these people, because the US happened to have one foot in the allies, you know, in the fight against fascism. Only for that reason do we other, because really this is the ideology of what Marx called the slave owner conspiracy, the ruling classes. He saw it being fought by the Parisians, the communards, he called them the slave owner conspiracy. And these are that's really capital, right? It's those American slave owners dreaming of their new Memphis on the Mississippi, right? Mm-hmm. They really had that view of the, it comes out of the 18th century manor house in England. You can picture it, or Jane Austen looks out the window and doesn't see anyone working.
Absolutely. Ever. Right.
But in the racialized version of this that reconciled it to liberalism, with the racial trick saying, oh yes, we're all equal, it's just those aren't people. And that's right. Really what fascism is just a European adaptation of that. So in a way we're it's a misnomer when we talk about fascism. These our ruling class, the American ruling class, is really American. There's something Dixie about them. There's
Yeah, and I think that's an important topic, because there is. And I remember my old friend and teacher, Terry Orrick, used to say that. He was fascinated with the American expression of the ruling class, the American ruling class, and their aesthetic, as it were, because it is distinct. And we're seeing, the 21st century version of a lot of this now is taking very curious form, I think. And it is not that it culminates in Trump. I mean, Trump's like a distraction. I mean, he's interesting as a symbol of certain things, but it's more the way this environmental movement, Corey Morningstar, I will give a shout out to Corey Morningstar because her work has been so invaluable in really singling out the voices of the ruling class as they erupt and emerge in stark relief in this environmental movement. And they do as well, of course, in the coronavirus narrative. I mean, this is Bill Gates, self-proclaimed emperor of the world, right?
Yeah, and it's Trump.
And it's very curious.
He's anyway, a rhetorical device like Archie Bunker, basically.
Right. I'm just looking at the time, and I think we have to soon here because we're sort of winding up we don't have to, but I think we take these in chunks, but we should do part three, obviously. But I would what you just started to talk about, I think, is really important, and And you have always had good things to say about it. And Michael, too, you know, on the American 21st century and the way, you know, and the aesthetics in Hollywood. I mean, we should talk about more about current films and how they express certain things. I mean, I made this point with Disney, you know, who was making this elaborate, what you described, Molly, you know, the imitation, Renaissance, whatever. And then you see The Sound of Music with all these widescreen 50s Panavision and Super Panavision, CinemaScope. And then they were using 70 millimeter and stuff. And now it's Christopher Nolan and directors like that that are using this unnecessary, you know, huge film stock and widescreen. Because it's a further, that's a ideological component of what they're saying. I mean, this is, these are the through lines that at least I find interesting. I don't know. Let's sort of end here. But any further thoughts, last comments from everybody?
Yeah, just one quick thing. So I was thinking about the concept of the pristine nature idea. And, you know, it's famously the start of Robin Hood, as he kills the king's deer. Great.
Yeah.
The king owns the deer because he has just the right to own it. And the deer is just there to be seen. It's beautiful, so it has to stay. It's not to be eaten. It's not to be used by the peasantry. It's just there for the king's observation, which I think is really kind of where this all comes from.
But that returned in the film version, The Queen, the film they made about the queen.
Right.
She has her spiritual moment.
Oh,
with the
right.
The same fucking deer, I'm quite sure.
Oh, wow. That's right. With Helen Mirren.
Yeah.
That's the only scene I've seen from that movie. That's so funny. I was wondering because I was like, where is it from? You know, and it's interesting because these stupid video games, which kind of inspire this bad CGI and stuff like that, is developed for that. They put you in the place of the emperor all the time with at the same time that they fuse it to your in absolute subjection to the algorithm. The algorithm right. controls the whole world around you. You're the only thing alive in this universe. So you're its master, but you're also its slave. It's like, you know, the shitty fantasies of Foucault, you know, it really is that. And the other thing I want to say we should pick up next time is, you know, you started talking about Deleuze with Guy Zimmerman, but I think Deleuze is the leader among these of this re-enchantment, this attempt to re-enchant, and then he goes off in a bad direction because he's so caught up with the idea of the flows of capital are the actual the discovery or the self-discovery of the productive flows, like
right,
the actual
right.
flows of the universe. Like he confuses these things, and then he winds up having all this neoliberal stuff. But the idea of that our capacities, you know, because what's being lost now in the logic of the ordinary people, clerk class only, the clerks of all economic levels, no longer believe in, rights, right? Natural law or anything that are rights derived from our needs and our capacities to satisfy them. Like for them, that's done. There's only something above us, some logic, the algorithm's logic, the race's logic, the civilization's logic, capital's logic, that will judge whether we have a right to exist.
Yeah, that's good. And my final thought is going to be just this idea of anticipation, you know, aesthetic, artistic anticipation of, you know, that we dream the future. Because I was thinking all this social distancing is creating the imagery that goes along with that in people's minds is Jacques Tati and playtime. It's Billy Wilder, the apartment. I mean, it's those kind of, it's Mad Men. It's those offices, cubicles where people were separated and working in isolation. Social distancing was already in existence. You know, I mean,
like remember Working Girl, like actually, you know, the last shot of Working Girl would be the horrible first shot, the nightmare first shot of a 1960s movie. Like she's in a cubicle in this massive skyscraper and she has a middle management job. And that would be like in the first shot in 1960s, she'd have to escape there and go across the country and, you know, and instead that's her reward at the end of that movie.
Right. And even at one point you have office space where every day since the day I started working is the worst day of my life.
That's a funny movie.
Well, this is great. I like this as an end point. Jack Littman will work on this tonight. A shout out to Jack Littman, who has been so great in helping with everything.
Thank you for all your help, Jack.
And I want to thank everybody who has been promoting Aesthetic Resistance on Instagram and listening to our podcast. There's a lot of people doing that, and that's cool. And we'll probably try to get another one out here Easter week in the quarantine. The kitsch plague of 2020.
Let's end the quarantine before them. Let's just go out and fucking end this nonsense.
I know. Somebody was saying, you know, my kids want to see their grandparents. They want to do all these things. And I just, you know, to my grandchildren in LA, if you want to come visit me in Norway, you can. If it were up to me,
The flights are going, I see. They're still booking flights now.
Just fucking crazy. Anyway, okay, guys.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I'll be in touch. And this will be up on.
Thank you for having us, John.
On SoundCloud this evening. Okay. Ciao.
Great. Ciao. Bye.
I'll see you.